This evening, we are pleased to welcome him once again as he takes a look at the Iraq conflict with some provocative comparisons with the Second World War. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Mr. David Irving.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, here I am fresh from that tour that Mark just referred to, the tour of Hungary, which lasted for 10 days. I visited all the major cities. I spoke to an audience of 10 or 15,000 people in Herod Square as one of the two major speakers on their Hungarian national holiday, October the 23rd. One of the other speakers, in fact, Jean-Marie Le Pen. It was an unusual experience to speak to a crowd that size. You have to have a completely different speaking technique than to an audience of this size, where, to my regret, I see we have three or four empty chairs still. And I came fresh from Budapest, flew back to England, and since then I've come straight here. Well, not quite straight here. I came via Chicago, Cleveland, New Orleans, Louisville, Houston, Dallas, Oklahoma City, Dallas, and all these other places. Some tapes on the back of my other speeches already there, which is very similar to what I'm going to be saying today. In Oklahoma City, I reminded the local audience there that I was familiar with their tragedy, the Oklahoma City, the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995, because at that time I was in the United States, and I was accused of having supplied the trigger mechanism for the bomb. Stephen Jones, the defender of Timothy McVeigh, he mentioned on a program, a Sacramento television program, the Sacramento Bee reported that it was believed that the right-wing extremist David Irving had supplied the trigger mechanism for the bomb, with the result that I was subjected to a telephone call from Associated Press asking if this was true, and I felt absolutely repulsed by the idea of having had anything to do with that outrage. And I wouldn't know where to buy a trigger mechanism for a bomb. I wouldn't know which aisle of Kmart to go to where you get trigger mechanism. And I said so, and it subsequently turned out Stephen Jones apologized. He wrote me a letter saying, "I now know who you are. I'm terribly sorry that I said that. I now know who you are. I was fed the information by the Jewish Telegraph Agency in New York, the usual smearmongers." He said, "It subsequently turned out that I had several of your books on my bookshelf.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So I know now who you are." And that's kind of the introduction to this evening's talk on Iraq and World War II comparisons, which is the title I've given this talk. I've been living around the United States. Because when American troops arrived victorious, as they thought, in Baghdad in April 2003 and raided the palaces of Saddam Hussein, who's still missing, of course, on the wanted list, and the other Iraqi leaders, they raided the empty palace of the Deputy Prime Minister, Tariq Aziz. Tariq Aziz, you may remember, was the very civilized, urbane Iraqi. He was the respectable face of the Iraqi diplomacy. He was always the United Nations. He spoke very good English. He was a Christian, in fact. He wasn't a Muslim. He wore a suit, a collar and tie. He was probably out with a knife and fork. He was a respectable Iraqi. He didn't go around firing rifles in the air and doing this kind of ungentlemanly thing. He was the nice guy. That is, until they raided his palace, and they looked in his bedroom, and on the bedside table of Tariq Aziz, the Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq, they found David Irving's Hitler's War. Well, you Americans laugh about this, of course. You're laughing on the other side of your face now, because if George Bush read David Irving's Hitler, he doesn't read books, of course. He doesn't even read newspapers. At least President Eisenhower used to read cowboy stories, westerns, paperbacks. George Bush has made a great thing of not reading anything at all. I know that this book was there because the Washington Post, April 11, 2003, published a report on everything they found in Tariq Aziz's home and in his bedroom. And I chuckled out loud at the thought that they had been reading my book and learning some facts from it. For example, how to defeat overwhelming enemies. If they had read my book, Hitler's War, in West Point or in the Citadel or in Annapolis or in any of the other great military academies of your own great nation, instead of allowing themselves to be prevailed upon to withdraw it from the bookshelves of those institutions, as they were when the Anti-Defamation League protested upon learning that my book, Hitler's War, was required reading at West Point and at the other military institutes in this country. And all my books have now been withdrawn from the shelves of those military institutions in this country, thanks to the pressure of the Anti-Defamation League. It remains on the shelves of the academic institutions because academia doesn't so easily bow to this kind of outside pressure. Governments aren't involved. If you go to the Harvard University Library, the Widener Library, you'll find 42 of my books on their shelves still, not yet withdrawn. But Tariq Aziz was reading my book, and this is, I think, where their present tactics come from. I'm not saying that I told them how to fight the war against the Americans, because otherwise next time I'm going to be in deep trouble with Tom Ridge and your Homeland Security people. That's going to be the next of my problems. They'll say he's the one who masterminded the Iraqi defense. 381 American soldiers already owe their lives to having the Iraqis having read Mr. Irving's master plan. Not true. If they had learned from history, however, the United States Army would not be in the predicament, the mess, the quagmire that it now is. Wafer thin, ladies and gentlemen, wafer thin is the divide that separates the war that couldn't be lost from the war that can't be won. And this is where you stand today. You thought you had won the war. It was the end of major combat operations. President Bush himself proclaimed it on the decks of the USS Roosevelt in front of that great banner, mission accomplished. And here you are now, months later, and the mission is not accomplished. In fact, it's getting worse and worse every day. And an American general admitted only a few days ago on a minor television program, he says, we have to accept that Saddam Hussein is probably still there, probably still running the defense of his country, and he is masterminding the partisan operation. He used the word partisan. He didn't call them terrorists or thugs. The U.S. Army knows what they're up against. Sophisticated underground operations fighting against an overwhelming superpower, which is precisely what the Soviet Army did in 1941, as you learn from the pages of Hitler's War. July the 6th, 1941, Joseph Stalin, having initially been taken deeply by shock by the German attack, which was an overwhelming attack with military superior power, gigantic German air force, huge quantities of tanks, thousands of tanks, a mighty Eastern Front armada rolling eastwards into the Soviet lines from Finland in the north right down to Romania in the south. This gigantic Eastern Front began to move. Stalin panicked for 4 or 5 days. On June the 22nd, on June the 28th, he sent for the foreign minister, Molotov, and he said, is the German ambassador still on Soviet territory? If so, I want to speak to him. I want to offer to Hitler the entire Ukraine, if that will stop the war right now. That was how much the Soviets were panicking after only a week of Hitler's attack. But by July the 6th, a few days later, Stalin had taken different counsel, and they had decided to let the Germans advance. These huge tank armadas, the panzer divisions, was advanced to the extreme limit of their supply lines. And when they got there, it would be the winter, and then the partisan armies would begin hacking at them in the rear, which is precisely what is happening now in Iraq. You probably remember hearing Tommy Franks, when he was questioned some months ago about Iraqi casualties. He gave a rather odd answer, which at the time looked rather insolent. General Tommy Franks, who was at that time the military commander of the forces in Iraq, the United States forces, he was questioned about the Iraqi casualties, meaning the military casualties. And he didn't give an exact figure. He was rather rude. He just replied to the journalist concerned, and he said, we're not into doing body counts. Not like Vietnam, where you got the body count every day, but we're not into doing body counts. And at the time, you probably understood that as being so many Iraqi soldiers have been killed by these massive carpet bombing operations you've seen on television. Nobody going to survive these gigantic carpets of bombs laid down, the daisy cutters, the jump up and kill 'em bombs, all the rest of the things that the United States had laid down, the assets that had been put down in the field against the wretched primitive Iraqi forces, that you didn't really want to admit that you had killed tens of thousands of soldiers so cheaply. But I think there was another possible explanation for this phrase he used, we're not into doing body counts. I think that when the American troops advanced, they were puzzled to find so few Iraqi soldiers being killed. That's the other explanation for that phrase he used. He never really explained himself. There's never been any figures, never any glorious triumphant claims of tens of thousands killed at Nazareth or any of the other battles that were fought by the Americans. Just occasional skirmishes here and there, but apart from that, the Iraqi army melted into the sand, in my view. Melted into the sand to rise again weeks later in the rear of the advancing armies, just as the Soviet armies did it in 1941 and 1942, at a time when the Germans thought they'd already won. If you read Hitler's War, if you read the private diary, which I quote there, of Walter Havel, General Jodl, the chief of the operations staff of the German High Command, at the beginning of October 1941, says, it's over, we've won. The battle can't be lost now. Exactly the same as the Americans thought in April 9, 2003. You thought the battle was over because you were in the streets of Baghdad, surrounded by cheering crowds. Or where were the cheering crowds? This is the first problem you have in the United States, the fact that your government is lying to you, not just about the reasons for the war, the excuses for the war. You notice the word excuses. I always taught when I was young, the more the excuses, the less the excuse. When you're a child, you don't say, well, I did it because of this, oh, and because of that, oh, and I'm sorry, this also kicked in. Give just one excuse and stick to it, and you've got a chance of getting away with it. Keep on coming up with a fresh excuse, and it gets less plausible each time. And this is what's happened, as Mark was saying in the earlier part of this talk. The United States government has given reason after reason after reason after reason why you're in Iraq today, and the more excuses, the more pretexts, the more excuses it puts forward for you being there, the less plausible it sounds. Just like World War II. Why were we in attacking Germany? Churchill was asked about this repeatedly in the later years of the war. What are our war aims? And he was very careful not to nail himself fast to any particular war aim. Originally, when we attacked, when we declared war on Germany on September the 3rd, 1939, the reason was, oh, we got to go to Germany's aid because we signed a guarantee to Poland that if anybody attacked Poland, then we would go in and rescue Poland. Bit of a problem there, because 2 weeks later the Soviet Union also attacked Poland from the east. So why didn't we attack Poland the same way we attacked Germany, declare war on the Soviet Union? What you don't know is that there was a secret appendix to the Anglo-Polish agreement, military agreement. The secret appendix said this agreement only kicks in if Germany attacks Poland. The only enemy concerned by this agreement, this treaty, is Poland. In other words, that killer phrase, some restrictions apply. If the Soviet Union attacks Poland, don't expect us to come to your aid. This is typical British perfidy. The genuine full version of the Anglo-Polish agreement was only put into the British archives a few years ago when people pointed out that there were bits of it missing. Rather the same, but then of course, after Poland was defeated in 1939, our pretext for being in the war was gone. There was no Poland, so why were we still fighting? Well, Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, then gradually changed the shift, the emphasis. It all sounds rather familiar. We were no longer fighting on Poland's behalf, we were fighting to defend the British Empire against Adolf Hitler. Now, I know, having spoken to all Adolf Hitler's private staff, personally, I knew them all, his private secretaries, the generals, the colonels, the survivors, read their papers, read all the documents, spent 30 years writing it. I know that the British Empire was never threatened by that man. On the contrary, he told Christa Schroeder, his private secretary, and she wrote it in a letter in June 1940, the chief is very, very pro-British. It hurts him to see the British being hurt in this war. This was just after Dunkirk. He doesn't want any harm to come to the British Empire. He told the British in his peace offer that summer, the secret peace offer that was channeled to them through various channels, I'm prepared to provide German divisions to assist the British Empire if it is invaded by anybody, including Italy, Russia and Japan, his own allies at that time. He was our best friend. But we made our best friend Roosevelt, who privately said in April 1942 to Vice President Henry Wallace, my greatest ambition in life is to see the destruction of the British Empire, beginning with India. And he was our ally. War gets very confusing when you look to see what actually happened, the real history, as I call it. It's difficult then to work out why we are at war with the Germans and why we were making friends with the... I think that Roosevelt was the finest president you've ever had. And I know I shock you saying that. Looked at from the purely selfish American point of view, he was the finest president you had because he destroyed four empires. He sucked the blood out of them. The German Empire, British Empire, the French Empire, and the Dutch Empire. He helped us out. 1940, 1941, he helped us out. He helped us out of everything we had. So he was the finest president you had had from the strictly selfish American point of view. But one thing is quite plain. When Chamberlain said, the new reason for the war is to defend the British Empire. In fact, you weren't going to win the Americans by saying that. Eventually, when Churchill came to office in May the 10th, 1940, a new war aim had to be found, and it became this. We are fighting the brutal dictatorship of Adolf Hitler, and it's our intention to bring democracy and freedom to the German people. It all sounds very familiar, doesn't it? How gradually the war aims shift when the underlying reason for the war is probably something quite different. That's how it was, of course, in the war against Iraq. It started off with the weapons of mass destruction. As Marx said, George Bush, your own illustrious president, believed, or pretended to believe, that man, Saddam Hussein, had a carrying system, a weapons vehicle capable of transporting weapons all the way across the Atlantic from the Middle East to American citizens carrying significant warheads of either well, God knows what kind of explosives or biological weapons. Turns out he had nothing of the sort. He had no weapons. He had no weapons of mass destruction. Well, you've spent a lot of money trying to find those weapons of mass destruction, which you were first told about. And as they turned out to be unfindable, gradually the cause for the war shifted. It then became bringing democracy and freedom to the Iraqi people. It then became regime change, although George Bush himself had said that he wasn't in the business of regime change. It then became getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who was the most brutal dictatorship who's ever lived. Although, of course, you were the ones who appointed him in the first place. The United States and the Central Intelligence Agency, you hired him as a puppet, as a quisling, and you appointed him there. It's the same as you've appointed that other quisling, Hamid Karzai, in Afghanistan, and you've tried to appoint Ahmed Halabi in Iraq and other quislings. You see, the word quisling is a word you're not seeing in the American press about these people. They're American-appointed prime ministers. But Hitler also appointed prime ministers, and they were called quislings, and they suffered the fate that quislings suffer. They were hanged and despised when the war was over because they had failed to deliver the goods. They'd done Hitler absolutely no good at all. And the Americans haven't learned from the history of that either. When you didn't find the weapons of mass destruction, you send in David K. I don't know what the K stands for. I've offered a prize on my website. Who knows what his name originally was? Usually when people are called K-A-Y, it's an abbreviation of some Central European name, which is unpronounceable for us normal human beings. And I do apologize that there's no menorah here today, ladies and gentlemen. I'm deeply offended by the fact that there's just a Christmas tree here. So David Kay set out to the Middle East, and he came back after a few weeks and had to apologize rather shamefacedly that his high hopes of finding weapons of mass destruction had been dashed. So George Bush gave him $1 billion. He said, you are entitled to spend $1 billion of your taxpayers' money in the attempt to find the missing weapons of mass destruction in the knowledge that this will take at least another year, which will take you beyond the November watershed next year. Now, I get worried by that $1 billion figure. If somebody offered me $1 billion to find a weapon of mass destruction, I could come up with one pretty quickly, I think. The paint may be a bit fresh, but it would be a convincing weapon of mass destruction that we could parade before the press. On my website, some of you may know, I offer $1,000 to anybody who can find a single document proving that Hitler knew what was going on in the Holocaust, in Auschwitz, or whatever. A genuine wartime document giving the proof. I've offered $1,000, and people say, why only $1,000? I've offered it since 1977, when this first edition came out. People say, why only $1,000? Well, if I offered $1 billion, somebody would find that document, obviously. There'd be no problem at all. And that's why you've got to be within reason. And I'm very suspicious about that $1 billion, but I'm dealing with the weapons of mass destruction as the initial pretext, then it became the bringing freedom and democracy. I hope it's not democracy Florida style, but I hope it's democracy kind of democracy style, ancient Greece style, and then it goes on to getting rid of Saddam Hussein. So you've got all these different pretexts. But it's the weapons of mass destruction and the inability to find them, and quite clearly the fact that they never existed in the first place, that worries me. You remember Colin Powell, I'd fall into the habit of mispronouncing his name the way he does himself. You remember how Colin Powell in the United Nations pointed to that screen behind him in the first of his two visits to the United Nations Security Council when he's trying to persuade the rest of the Security Council that they had to sign a declaration of war against Iraq. And to do that, he cooked up various pretexts and excuses. And at the first occasion, he came up with I think there was an air photograph of an emplacement of some kind, taken by satellites, showing, first of all, trucks of some kind in this concrete emplacement, and then a few days later, big drama, the trucks aren't there. Therefore, there were weapons of mass destruction which had to be moved. And everybody was deeply impressed by this. We rather like Colin Powell. He's kind of not black, he's not white, but he does have this kind of serious academic kind of aura about him. He's a man you can trust. And I think he believed that this is the problem for him. He was fed with fake documents and information, and he believed it along with the rest. He also showed a document purporting to show that Iraq had been trying to obtain from some country in Africa quantities of uranium ore. The country's name was actually Niger, N-I-G-E-R. Very unfortunate. I'm going to call it the N country because I don't want to have any problems at all with this audience. So he tried to obtain from the N country a number of tons of uranium ore. But the first thing that you have to say is the tons of uranium ore he was attempting to procure, according to this document, were insignificant. From those tons of uranium ore, you would have boiled down a few grams of uranium metal,
And from those few grams of uranium metal, you would have managed to extract only a few micrograms of uranium-235, which is the weapons-grade explosive. That's not important. The important thing is the document that Colin Powell first of all showed the United Nations turned out to be a negotiation with a minister who didn't even exist at the time that the document was dated. He'd been out of office for 10 years, so the document was fake. What does that tell you about your own intelligence services? The CIA, who provided it to Colin Powell, British Intelligence, MI6, who provided it to the CIA, and we can only guess who provided it to the MI6. I've got my own suspicions. I think it begins with M and ends with Ossad, but I'm going to give up no other clue other than that. At any rate, they provided the document to the United Nations, and it turned out to be so as baloney as a $3 bill, if I can put it like that. It was a total giveaway, the fact that the minister didn't even exist at the time the document was allegedly dated. Nobody had spotted it, despite all the billions of dollars that are spent on your intelligence services in this country. But it gets worse, ladies and gentlemen. He also pointed on the screen, you remember the transcript of the conversation, the overheard conversation between Iraqi officials, which is the real killer. Two or three days earlier, he had begun predicting that he was going to produce NSA information from the National Security Agency, the eavesdropping agency, and he was going to produce this real killer, the real clinching data, which would leave no possible doubt in the minds of the Security Council that Saddam Hussein was trying to conceal weapons of mass destruction. And on my website, I predicted, oh, this is going to be the old telephone transcript scam. Because I'll explain why I say that, telephone transcript scam, the NSA. It's going to be that old story all over again. Let's see what he cooks up this time. And sure enough, the transcript they showed on the screen, it may have been one or two conversations, allegedly the NSA had eavesdropped on cell phone conversations between various Iraqi military officials, which went roughly like this. Ahmed, I hope you managed to hide those weapons of mass destruction in time. And Ahmed replies saying, Colonel, sir, Colonel, don't worry, I've got them out of the way, they're never going to find nothing. Right? And Colin Powell says, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Not only have they had the weapons, but they're doing everything they can to prevent us from finding these weapons, and Iraq is deliberately trying to flout the will of the United Nations, Resolution 1441 and all. What do we now realize about that transcript and that conversation? If there were no weapons of mass destruction, as we now accept, despite all the money being paid to David Kaye and the rest of it, if the whole story about the weapons of mass destruction was baloney, then how can that conversation have taken place? There was no such conversation. The transcript was phony, just like the document about the uranium being purchased from the end country, and that phony series of photographs about these milk trucks or something being driven out of a building somewhere in the desert. You're being sold a bill of goods. A pack of lies. What worries me is how your press hasn't spotted this kind of thing. Or if they have spotted it, how they haven't dared to print it. I mean, I'm only of medium intelligence, and your newspaper men are of super intelligence, and they've got lots of money. And they must also have spotted the fact that if there were no weapons of mass destruction, therefore that transcript of the conversation you were shown must be fake. And why aren't they mentioning it? I'm going to come back to the quality of the American press later on in this talk. But first of all, let's just dwell on transcripts for a moment. This isn't the first time that the American people, the American administration, the American regime, let's swap the words around a bit and talk about the Iraqi government or administration and the Washington regime. I mean, it begins to confuse the issue, but it balances the playing field. The Washington regime has fed transcripts to you in the past. There was an occasion when the Israelis decided to send in a commando team into Tunisia, a peaceful country in North Africa. They sent a commando team into Tunisia a few years ago to take out, to assassinate a number of Yasser Arafat's closest lieutenants at his headquarters, which at that time was in Tunisia. And the justification was, as the NSA revealed, that they had overheard telephone conversations between two Palestinian officials close to Yasser Arafat in Tunisia planning terrorist actions. Years later, I think as Ostrovsky, one of the Mossad agents concerned, published his memoirs in which he revealed that they had the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, had imported into Tunisia its own agents with their own telephone systems who conducted these spurious telephone conversations for the NSA to intercept and transcribe. And the NSA fell for it, or they probably fell for it with a wink and a nudge because they knew what was going on. And they showed it to the president, and therefore it was okay for the Israelis to go ahead and carry out their murder operations. But I think I remember further back than that. I remember when your country first got into the business of trying to take out enemy heads of state, or not enemy heads of state, but any head of state. Watch out, Tony Blair, if you don't do what we're saying. There's a cruise missile coming down the turnpike this moment. You tried to kill Colonel Gaddafi. You sent in a bombing raid. You bombed his palace. You failed to kill Colonel Gaddafi because he's very unpredictable. You managed to kill one of his daughters. But this was a country at peace with you. No declaration of war. But you went in to try to kill the head of state. And then you wonder why crimes are committed against your own people, like September the 11th, 2001. But that's another story. What I'm talking about is this. An NSA transcript was also provided as the pretext for that operation. You know, a little known fact is that one of my admirers, was somebody called Bill Casey. You may remember Bill Casey. He used to be the head of the CIA, a friend of Ronald Reagan's. I know he was an admirer because several years ago, about the time this book first came out, 1977, I was taking a train from Oxford back to London. I've been down, I don't know why, to Oxford. And I took the train back to London, and as I walked down the swaying gangway, the corridor of the train, past the first class compartments, this gentleman stepped out and he said, "Mr. Irving, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Bill Casey's the name." The drooping lip. I was familiar with his name, of course, because in World War II he was can we have the heating turn up a bit? It's getting slightly chilly in here, I think. Because in World War II he was a close friend of, he was a close assistant of Alan Dulles, the head of the OSS in Switzerland. He said, I went and sat in the first class compartment with him for the rest of the journey back to London. He said, "I'm a great admirer of your work, Mr. Irving. I've read Hitler's War. In fact, I'm a great admirer of Hitler. That's the kind of guy we need to run the United States today." Now, not many people know that Casey was that kind of man, and he didn't go around telling that to the Washington Post, I don't think. Not in the days of Catherine Graham, anyway. But he told me this. And at the end of our very interesting conversation, he said, "It'd been nice to know you, Mr. Irving." I gave him the address. He wrote me a letter some weeks later from New York, headed William D. Casey, attorney at law, because at that time he wasn't chief of the CIA. He hadn't become that yet, nor had Reagan become president yet. And he invited me to visit him whenever I felt like it. And the time came when I filed that letter away. Years later, I did my filing. I came, "Good Lord, I know that name, head of the CIA. Take him up on it." The next time I was in Washington, D.C., I phoned him, and he said, "Sure, come." So I found myself at the front entrance of McLean. I still got the parking ticket that was issued to me by the CIA parking police. They have that thing. They dated May the 1st, 1987. And I was greeted in the downstairs lobby by gentlemen wearing very discreet uniforms, young men with blow-dried hair and ramble handshakes, who took me up to his seventh-floor penthouse. It was that kind of elevator that has only a one button and a seven button on it. You just went straight from the ground floor up to the director's office. And I went in to see him, and we spent the whole afternoon talking. I often wondered why he could. I wondered who was running the CIA while he was talking to me. But apparently, Bill Casey had a liking for authors, rather like Michael Jackson has a liking for small boys. Bill Casey liked authors, and he invited not just me, but David Kahn and Sir John Keegan and all sorts of other authors, which he found out years later by comparing. And he knew a lot about me. He said, "How is the brown Rolls-Royce, David?" Obviously he'd been checking up. And I didn't say cut the crap, Bill, but I did say one thing. I said, "Bill, about this bombing raid you've recently carried out on Tripoli." He said, "Yes." And I said, "What was the justification for it?" He said, "Well, you've read the transcripts, the NSA transcripts, like anybody else, haven't you?" And I said, "Well, I've read the recent transcripts in the New York Post, I think it was, or New York Times." And in the New York Times, a few months before around the time of the raid, it revealed that the NSA had intercepted telephone conversations, there we go again, between a Libyan diplomat in East Berlin, Communist East Berlin, telephoning across the wall with Palestinian terrorists or some kind of terrorists in West Berlin, congratulating them on having carried out the bombing of a disco in West Berlin, killing several American GIs. And that's the justification, because they had the NSA transcript. And I said, "Bill, yes, I read the transcript like everybody else, but I also read the first version of that transcript published in the Washington Post about 3 or 4 months ago. And on that occasion, the wording was slightly different, and the diplomat who made the phone call across the wall from East Berlin to the West wasn't a Libyan, he was a Palestinian, because you needed to justify an operation you were carrying out in Palestine at that time." Bill said, "What's the point you're trying to get at, David?" And I said, well, you and I both know it wasn't Palestine and it wasn't Libya who was behind the bombing of the discotheque. Most likely it was Syria. Bill Casey said, well, David, Palestine, Syria, let me tell you one thing about the goddamn American public. The goddamn American public doesn't know the difference between Syria and Libya. So that's the way they did it. They just kind of filled in on the dotted line whichever country they intended to go and bomb the head of state of at the moment. So next time you see NSA transcripts being published in the press or thrown on the wall of the Security Council chamber in the United Nations, bear that in mind. Three times in history already they've been caught out, faking transcripts to justify what... I'm sure the NSA does wonderful work, but it also has its public face when it just provides propaganda fodder for the politicians. Whatever they ask is produced to order and thrown on the screens in the council chambers around the world to justify what the Americans are up to. One use of the NSA, for example, during the Iraq crisis was when the NSA was given the job of eavesdropping on the telephone conversations of the few recalcitrant members of the Security Council who were not towing the American line. And the NSA was told to listen into all their private conversations to try and dig up some dirt on them that could be used to persuade them to change their mind. And because the NSA, had, the Americans, have everybody in their pay now, the British outposts of the NSA were directed to carry out the same listening watch on these foreign diplomats of the United Nations diplomats. And a whistleblower at the British headquarters of GCHQ, which was being used by the NSA for this purpose, sent a copy of the document from Washington's NSA to the Observer newspaper who printed it as an example of the illegal tasks that British eavesdroppers are being asked to do at the request of George Bush. And that British whistleblower, who's a woman, has now been put on trial for violating the Official Secrets Act. You can expect to be sent to prison for 10 or 20 years. It's a disgraceful business. But I think it's more disgraceful that this kind of flimsy pretext is being cooked up to wage a war against an innocent people, and you have to accept that the Iraqis are entirely innocent of all the charges levelled against them, that you've gone marching in there, killing tens of thousands of civilians for all we know. I don't know how many soldiers, because of course we're not into doing body counts, but undoubtedly killing large numbers of Iraqi civilians, women and children, and it's all been done on a flimsy pretext. It's a war crime, and I'm going to come into this criminal element of it later on in this talk. Of course, your president recently visited Baghdad. Well, he didn't visit Baghdad, he visited a kind of place near Baghdad, and he stayed 2 hours. Some say he stayed as long as 2.5 hours. There's dispute here. I mean, the American media says 2.5 hours, the Arab media says they know it was only 2 hours. No real difference. Let's say he was there for 2.5 hours. He didn't exactly put on a soft hat and drive around in an open car touring the streets of Baghdad, though, did he? I mean, if we make comparisons here, when that other victorious emperor, Adolf Hitler, visited Paris 2 days after the defeat of France, after the armistice with France was signed, that was a genuine end of combat operations. Hitler flew to Paris with his cronies. There were three open cars waiting for him, and he was driven around the streets of Paris just after dawn, around about 8 or 9 in the morning, where all the astonished Paris French bystanders stood around pointing fingers at these open cars, saying, isn't that, don't I recognize, isn't that Adolf somebody? He took the risk. That we've seen the photographs of him standing there in his silly postman's hat and the crinkly boots, looking up at the Eiffel Tower, surrounded by Albert Speer and Benno von Arendt and the other top Nazis. What a difference. Your own president couldn't even venture out of the airport in Iraq. All the stories you were told about cheering crowds and bunches of flowers and all the rest of it didn't materialize and haven't happened, notwithstanding the media told you they did. You know, after the American forces arrived in Iraq, world's newspapers published photographs of the huge cheering crowds. The Evening Standard in London, the only evening newspaper in London, published a 2-page photograph, a photograph across 2 pages showing the huge cheering crowd greeting the Americans as they arrived in Baghdad at the end of their victorious thunder across the desert. And a lot of people pointed out, because they could easily spot it, the same man in a white shirt in the photograph appearing 8 or 10 times across the photograph, because it had been done by montage. They had multiplied this tiny crowd of people probably 20 or 30 times to make it look like an enormous crowd. Well, you can get away with it. What about the cheering crowds you've heard of? What about that picture of the statue being pulled down? You've seen the picture of the statue being pulled down. Cheering crowds there. Huge cheering crowds. You can hear the sounds. Next time you see it on television, as undoubtedly will, this picture of the Saddam Hussein statue being winched down by an American tank, Have a look at the number of people you can see. It's about 27. A lot of them Americans, wearing American uniform, helmets and flak jackets. The others are undistinguished civilians. We don't know who they are. We don't know if they came voluntarily or if they were paid to come and be in the shot. If there were huge cheering crowds, you can guarantee the camera would have pulled back and shown huge cheering crowds. But of course, they don't. It's always tight, close shot. But you can hear the sounds of the cheering crowds. Ladies and gentlemen, you can hear sounds of cheering audiences if you watch Cheers or Seinfeld or Friends, although the studio is empty. There's no audience at all, but you can hear the audience cheering. That's the way that Americans now do it. There's a similar problem with cheering crowds happened to the Americans in 1945. In 1946, Mr. Robert H. Jackson, the chief American prosecutor at Nuremberg, was putting together the evidence to be used at the Nuremberg war crimes trials, on which he was a great believer. He had drafted the body of law that he thought would lead to the end of war for all time. And now he is putting the 22 principal defendants on trial for committing war crimes and crimes against the peace, and they were assembling the evidence for this dramatic opening sequence. And one of the pieces of evidence they were putting together was a film, a compilation of newsreel film called Nazi Crimes and Aggression. And they were going to show this film in the courtroom at Nuremberg, and Bill Donovan, Lieutenant Bill Donovan, wrote Jackson a letter, which I found in the files in the Library of Congress of Robert H. Jackson. Donovan says, we've got a bit of a problem putting the film together. For example, when Hitler invaded Austria in 1938, huge cheering crowds greeted his troops as they crossed the frontier. And when he arrived in Vienna, and they greeted him with flowers and garlands and all the rest of it. We are going to have to cut those sequences out of the newsreels for the bits we're using for this film for the exhibit in Nuremberg. Because if we leave them in, it's going completely to negate our contention that by entering Austria, Hitler was committing a brutal act of aggression. So the scenes of cheering crowds were cut out of the Austria films. What a pity they couldn't use them for the Baghdad entry of the Americans. Problem was, of course, they were in black and white, and it would have been a bit odd. I suppose they could have kind of colorized them, rather the same as they colorized Lucy and Lucille Ball and her old movies. They could have kind of colorized the Austrian cheering crowds. Then people would have spotted that they were kind of Austrians wearing dirndl and all the rest of it, and the Viennese buildings in the background would have been a giveaway. And you've got problems, you see, because again and again the collar doesn't match the cuffs, if I can put it like that. You are being told that you are deposing Saddam Hussein, who was the most brutal dictator the Middle East has known for centuries. That he was hated by his people, he was responsible for the massacre of thousands, if not tens of thousands, of his own people. That he was despised and a despot and a bigot. And then at the same time, because they really can't avoid doing it, your TV stations show pictures of him on the last day of the American entry into Baghdad. The Americans pouring into the city on one side, and Saddam Hussein walking around freely and openly on the other side of the city, being greeted by his own soldiers and passers-by who can hardly believe their eyes. There's the chief himself walking around wearing a shirt and a silly beret on his hat, not wearing a flak jacket, not wearing a metal helmet, just walking around openly, surrounded by all these people, carrying guns. Any one of them could have said, oi, bang, that's it, finished. You're hated, a brutal despot. We're going to get rid. And this is the problem. If you're going to start a big lie, you've got to be consistent. And the media couldn't resist showing the photograph of Saddam Hussein, because you've so often had to put up with the old stock shots of him firing the rifle in the air. But here was the real Saddam Hussein walking around, and all your media could do was to say, well, we don't know whether it's really him or not, or a stand-in. We don't know when the picture was taken, but of course later on, as pointed out in the background, you could see the buildings that the Americans had damaged already with their cruise missiles, so it was undoubtedly taken during the war. There he was walking around quite openly and not being taken out. And this is the basic problem, of course, you've got. The mirage, which is constantly receding from you. You've got this belief that you are in the right, that you have the moral high ground, and yet you're lying about everything you do. You say that this man is unpopular, and yet your own president in your own country can't ride around in an open car. He rides around in a bullet. Ever since 1963, your presidents have been riding around in bulletproof Cadillacs with bulletproof glass and armor-plated undersides so that mines can't damage them, and bulletproof inch-thick steel doors, because that's how popular your presidents are in this country, and they're all terrified of their lives. Tony Blair can't ride around in England anymore in an open car. The Pope has to ride around in a Pope-mobile, just the same. Yet in the Leni Riefenstahl films that I had there, there's this Not Only Triumph of the Will that lots of you would have seen, but also this other one, the one that was taken a year before, The Victory of the Faith. At the beginning, there's a sequence. Leni Riefenstahl gave me a private one-on-one showing of it, of her famous Triumph of the Will. And she said, "Watch this, Mr. Irving. For 15 minutes, there is no commentary. We are sitting behind the chief in his car, filming over his shoulder. And sure enough, we're behind him in the car as the car drives through huge crowds of German citizens, millions of people lining the streets of Nuremberg. The police are lining the streets with their backs to the crowd. Now, of course, they face the crowd. But in those days, in England too, the police would line the streets with their backs to the crowd, saluting. Now they don't dare do that. They have to watch the crowd. And there's Hitler in the car, standing up, gripping the rail in the front, giving his silly little bent arm salute, and we're filming over his shoulder for 15 minutes as he drives past a million cheering people, any one of whom could have shot him dead on the spot. And it wasn't just at Nuremberg. Every time he did it, he was riding around in that open car. And I'm only familiar with one occasion when somebody actually tried to use the occasion to kill him. That was 1937, when a Swiss waiter called Maurice Bavaud, B-A-V-A-U-D, decided to take a... He had his own reasons as a Swiss. The Swiss are strange people, as the Holocaust Museum knows. This Swiss waiter decided, I'm going to take out this German leader because he's a bigot. He'd been told this. And he went to Munich one day with a gun in his pocket on one of these traditional state occasions, the anniversaries when Hitler would be driving past in his open car. And this Swiss waiter waited there with his hand on the pistol in his pocket, waited until the car came around the corner, just like Dealey Plaza, and waited until he could get a good shot. And as he took the gun out of his pocket, a huge forest of hands went up in front of him. Thousands of hands. And he couldn't get a shot at. And poor Maurice Bavaud, he couldn't say, "Excuse me, would you mind putting your hands down a second so I can kind of get a clear, draw a clear bead on this guy." He couldn't say that. He said the gun went back into his pocket. We know that because he was later on questioned by the Gestapo, because when he tried to repeat this a different way, Hitler, you see, used to stand on the edge of his mountainside villa at a path every afternoon when he was down in the Berghof at Berchtesgaden. Every afternoon at 2 o'clock after lunch, he would stand there and the villagers would come and file past him. All the visitors, all the tourists, whatever it was, they would come and say, "Hi, there he is," and held out the children. And he would, rain or cold, he would stand out there. In fact, even when he got very hot, he would stand there. And once he said to Martin Bormann, who was at that time, the estate manager at the Berghof, he said to Martin Bormann, "What a pity, I've got to stand on this open footpath just to carry out this ritual of letting the people file past me. What a pity there isn't a tree there that I could stand in the shade of. It would make it at least bearable." And the next day there was a 30-foot lime tree standing there. That was the power of being a dictator and being Martin Bormann. He could get things done. Maurice Bavaud, the assassin, decided that he was going to take out Hitler on this occasion. And he took a train from Munich to Berchtesgaden. Now the first lesson when you're going to assassinate somebody is buy a train ticket. He was stopped for travelling without a ticket. He was arrested by the Gestapo and taken to police headquarters. And during the interrogation, they found in his pocket an envelope addressed to the Führer and Reich Chancellor Adolf Hitler, containing no letter. A sealed envelope addressed to Hitler, containing no letter. When questioned as to why he was carrying this envelope, the suspect, Maurice Bavaud, said, "Well, I intended handing it to him with one hand and shooting him with the other." Now, this is not a wise thing to tell the Gestapo. And it ended up with poor Maurice Bavaud being guillotined a year later. This was the only attempt made to kill Hitler in all those years, so he was relatively popular, if you can put it like that, compared with George Bush, Tony Blair, any of these people. Hitler was and is so popular in Germany that about a couple of weeks ago they ran a television popularity poll in Germany. You know, one of these things, who is your most popular? And the question was, who is the German who you most respect over the last few hundred years? And then they had second thoughts about that question and they put in small brackets underneath, "Certain restrictions apply." There's one person you weren't allowed to vote for because they had discovered in initial tests that he would have swept the board. And so he was counted out, and it became a Florida-style popularity poll, the hanging chads and all the rest of it, and he went to some total nonentity, some pop singer. It's kind of democracy the Americans are familiar with. But that is the real situation. This is the true situation about popularities, and there's a lot of other comparisons between the United States and the Iraqi situation, and indeed the whole war on terror. because, of course, the war has, which started on being an attack on the weapons of mass destruction and became introducing freedom and democracy to Iraq and then getting rid of the Saddam Hussein government, has now become part of the war on terror. This is the latest seamless glide from one pretext to another. It's now part. The American army is now in Iraq as part of the war on terror. The implication being that Iraq was in some undefined way responsible for September 11, 2001, which is a total lie. As George Bush himself said some time ago, he said there is no connection between those two events. I would point out, in fact, to this audience that since September 11, 2001, there has not been a single act of terror on United States soil. The only terrorization that's existed in the United States since September 11, 2001 has been the terrorization of the American people by your own government, by the Department of Homeland Security. The ups and the downs, the reds, the yellows, the oranges, the different alerts, for which there's no discernible or perceptible reason. And we're never going to find out what the reason was for these changes in the alert status, not for the next 25 or 30 years, and then presumably in the documents, we'll find out there was no reason. It was purely a Pavlovian attempt to keep the American people subservient to the will of the American regime or the American administration or government. I'm sure that's what will turn out, because nothing has happened on American soil, which confirms my suspicion one day after the event that what happened on September the 11th wasn't the start of a war of terror against the American people, but in fact a one-off punishment of Wall Street and the people behind Wall Street who come from the corner you're familiar with for what they had been doing to the Palestinians and the innocent people of the Middle East. It was a one-off punishment, and therefore you need not expect any repetition. Because let's face it, if there was to be a repetition against the American people, there are many easier ways they could have done it. They could have really brought the American people down. Instead of sending their suicide bombers to a bus in Jerusalem and killing 3 people, or a restaurant in Tel Aviv and killing 10 more, they only have to send one suicide bomber to an American shopping mall like Tyson's Corner outside Washington, D.C., and they would bring down the American economy instantaneously. For months, nobody would dare to go in the shopping malls. And that would bring down the American economy, almost as surely as September the 11th itself did. And yet they're not doing that, because they have no beef against the American people or the American nation. All this story about Osama bin Laden, remember Osama bin Laden? Remember him? This story about Osama bin Laden having been carried out this attack because he hated the American way of life and because he hated the American freedom is ridiculous. If he had really hated the Americans, they would do something like that, instead of which they haven't. It's been a completely different story. In fact, I've not seen any connection between Osama bin Laden and September the 11th either. This appears to be another of those stories that has been concocted by your regime, the George Bush regime, in order to keep the American people subservient. It all reminds you, you know, and I have Mark Weber to thank for reminding me of this morning. I've said this in the earlier talks on the tour. You know, when the Nazis first came to power, they came to power as a minority government. Democratically, they were voted into power, into office, as the largest of the minority parties in Germany, and they were awarded the right to appoint the Chancellor, namely Adolf Hitler. And 2 months later, an incident happened on German soil, which enabled Hitler to get what he wanted. And this was the burning down of the Reichstag building, the German Parliament building, at the end of February 1933, a month after Hitler had come to power by elections. The Reichstag was burnt down. I don't think any respectable historian now claims that the Nazis themselves had a hand in it. In fact, since I found the Goebbels diaries in Moscow in the KGB archives, we know Hitler had no hand in it. It came to him as a total surprise. But he used it. He used the burning down of the Reichstag in order to pass what was called the Enabling Act. And in this Enabling Act, he arrogated to himself the right to arrest his opponents without trial and put them in prison, to search, to enter, to plunder, to telephone, to impose telephone surveillance, to spy on people, to have them locked away, all the things you're now familiar with, suspension of habeas corpus, all the things that are beginning to happen in the United States in consequence of September the 11th. The Enabling Act for Hitler is identical to the Patriot Act for the United States government. In fact, they even appointed a special department that would take over the security of the fatherland from this point on, because it was considered that the German people were going to be submitted to a campaign of terror by the people who were behind the Reichstag fire. If you read all the measures that were taken by the Nazis after the Reichstag fire of 1933, it all has a horribly familiar ring for those who've been following events in the United States since the year 2001, September 2001. You don't have to be a cynic. It leaps out of the pages at you, the history books. But of course, the American government didn't read history books. If you read history books, then you can understand very well what has been going on in the Middle East. Not just the partisan warfare, which is now beginning to bring down the American army, but the reasons why you were there in the first place. Some months ago, a waste paper dealer in Philadelphia contacted me. And he said that he had obtained the rights to clean out the home of the late Robert M. W. Kempner, who was Jackson's deputy at Nuremberg. And I had always known that Robert Kempner, who was an American German-born Jew, who had that he'd stolen huge quantities of documents from the Nuremberg files, some of them even before they reached the archives, before they reached the lawyers, because they were valuable documents. And this waste paper dealer contacted me as an expert on Nazi Germany, and he said, I've got 300 boxes of stuff from Robert Kempner's papers, 300 boxes of original German documents. Do you want to come and have a look at them? Tell me what they're worth. The only reason I'm mentioning this is there was one document there, a six-page handwritten war diary of the Sonderstab Oldenburg. The Special Staff Oldenburg, which was a code name, had been set up in January 1941 by the German High Command to plan the economic exploitation of the Soviet Union after its defeat. They're going to seize their oil, their manganese, their nickel, their coal, their petroleum, everything they've got. We're just going to is the economic exploitation of the Soviet Union after the successful military defeat. And I think that somewhere in the American files, the Pentagon files, 20 or 30 years from now, you're going to find the American equivalent of the Sonderstab Oldenburg, which was set up so eagerly in the euphoria of the planning stages for the Iraqi campaign for the economic exploitation of Iraq. And this was the real reason why your armies were sent in there. Nothing to do with democracy or Saddam Hussein's brutality or the gassing of the Kurds or anything else. It was the Halliburton reason. You could put it like that. Although I'm probably being unjust to Halliburton. There are probably other companies involved. But it was the Halliburton reason that the Americans went in. Big business, looking ahead, seeing you're going to be needing petroleum. It may have been water, for all we know. It may have been the water of the Tigris and Euphrates, which Israel wanted. But it was some economic reason that propelled your armies across the waters to the Middle East and caused the American government to prostrate itself in this unseemly manner, offering huge sums of money, not just to countries like Turkey to allow the American forces to pass through into northern Iraq, but offering huge sums of money for the killing of heads of state and their members of their family. This is unseemly. It's disgusting. It's disgraceful. No previous American governments have got up to this kind of behavior. Whatever you may think of Jimmy Carter, one thing he did do was pass an executive order making it a criminal offense for any American agency to bring about the assassination of a foreign politician or head of state. One thing you can say about Jimmy Carter, this was revoked by George Bush. The Americans now, as Mark Weber rightly said, are despised around the world. You don't know this because you're living in a bubble here. You're protected by your own media from the knowledge that you are despised around the world. Where I lived in London until my home was seized by the British government in May last year, it was 100 yards from the American Embassy. In the most beautiful district of London called Mayfair, the American Embassy is in the heart of Mayfair in Grosvenor Square. And a few weeks ago, all the residents of Mayfair signed a petition asking the British government to tell the Americans to take their embassy somewhere else, because they have wrecked the heart of London with the presence of the American Embassy. It's like an infectious, pus-spewing boil. Every street around the American Embassy has been sealed off. Concrete blocks have been placed everywhere, barbed wire entanglements. The traditional British bobby, the policeman, is now walking around carrying a heckler and Koch submachine gun because it's our duty to protect the Americans under diplomatic law, and we don't want it anymore. We don't want the Americans anymore. The Americans are now hated everywhere you go. And the poor Canadians are being hated too because we can't tell the difference between the accents. And you don't know this because you're living in this bubble. The media are not telling you the truth. And this is the second but last thing I'm going to be saying in this talk. Your media have let you down in precisely the same way as the German media let down their people during World War II by not revealing what they knew. Your media, however, isn't being dragooned by propaganda ministry. It is imposing the most insidious form of censorship, which is self-censorship. Your newspapers know the truth, not just about the Iraq war, but also about September the 11th, 2001. And They're not printing it, except for a few honourable exceptions, like the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, for example, which has done excellent work investigating the reasons for the plane crash of United Airlines Flight 93. The other thing I'm going to say is you've been let down by your political system. Until the money engine is brought to a halt in this country, which funds the politicians, the congressmen, the senators, the presidential races. Until this can be curbed and reined in, making it impossible for people to corrupt politicians in the way they have been corrupted in the last few years, then you are going to find yourselves being dragged into one adventure after another. I'm saying this with the utmost humility, and it's possibly insolent and impertinent to me as an outsider to say this, but I'm living outside the bubble, and I can see the problem that you're living with in this country. It's the money that is the root of the evil that has dragged the United States down into a position where you've lost the moral authority, you've lost the moral high ground, and you are now losing your soldiers in a war that you can't win. Thank you very much.